Our scripture reading this morning is taken from John, chapter 20, verses 24 to 29. This can be found on page 115 in the New Testament portion of your pew Bible. Reading from John, chapter 20, beginning at verse 24. Hear what the Spirit says to the church. But Thomas, who was called the twin, one of the 12, was not with them when Jesus came. So the other disciples told him, "We have seen the Lord." But he said to them, "Unless I see the mark of the nails in his hands, and put my finger in the mark of the nails and my hand in his side, I will not believe." A week later, his disciples were again in the house, and Thomas was with them. Although the doors were shut, Jesus came and stood among them and said, "Peace be with you." Then he said to Thomas, "Put your finger here and see my hands. Reach out your hand and put it in my side. Do not doubt, but believe." Thomas answered him, "My Lord and my God." Jesus said to him, "Have you believed because you have seen me? Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have come to believe." This is the word of the Lord.
Unlike most identical twins, Jim Springer and Jim Lewis share a first name instead of a last. The two were separated at birth and adopted by different families who, by coincidence, both named their respective sons James. So began parallel lives. Springer and Lewis shared not only a genetic code and a first name, but shared more or less the same life, independent of one another until the reunion 39 years after their initial separation. They grew up in different homes, and both were aware, barely, that they had a twin brother out there somewhere, but neither really gave it much thought. Springer's mom had told him that his twin had died, and Lewis simply wasn't interested in meeting his brother. That changed in 1977 when Lewis, who was 37, decided to track down his brother. He found Springer's name through a local courthouse, and the two of them spoke over the phone, both nervous wrecks. They agreed to meet, and their bond was restored on February 9th, 1979. Both consider that reunion today to be the most important day of their lives. Once they got talking, they discovered the remarkable similarities that they shared. Similarities that went beyond simple genetics and almost into Twilight Zone territory. Both were adopted by families living in Ohio and grew up 45 miles from each other. Both had childhood dogs named Toy. Both were married twice, first to women named Linda, second time to women named Betty. Both had children, including a son named James and Alan. Both lived in the only house on their block. Both were chain smokers. Both had woodworking shops in their garage. Both drove exclusively Chevrolets. And both served as sheriffs in their respective Ohio counties. To an outsider, it may seem as if the Jim twins, as they came to be called, may have been the same person. However, Jim Lewis noted that there are, after all, subtle differences. The differences, he said, between Jim and me might as well just be the differences between living in the city and living in the country. I wonder sometimes if the same thing happened with the gospel account of Thomas, who was called the twin. The Thomas that we meet in the New Testament is at times deliriously clueless and zealously passionate, sometimes deserving the moniker that he wears, Doubting Thomas, and sometimes faithful to a fault. But today's passage is his most famous, or his most infamous, depending on how you want to read it. It's here where we tend to shake our heads with Jesus' words ringing in our ears that blessed are those who believe without seeing, that we get to pat ourselves on the back and say we are that good and faithful disciple. But I want to suggest this morning that this reading might miss the point that John wants us to grasp. Belief, as the way that we talk about it today, is a state of thinking. We believe in the tooth fairy, or we don't. We believe in global warming, or we don't. We believe in propositions that require our consent, or we don't. But 2,000 years ago, belief had a very different connotation. The word that the New Testament uses, pistos, translates much more closely to trust than to knowledge. And so in that light, I think we find a different story in the story that we call so often Doubting Thomas. In fact, I think we meet a Thomas who displays a surprising amount of faith. It just might not always look like what we expect faith to look like 2,000 years down the road. We meet at first a Thomas who displays a remarkable faith as a commitment to God's people, even with their faults and their limitations. Here's why I think I hate the story is called the story of Doubting Thomas in so many of my Bibles. Because in view of the crucifixion, in view of watching what the Romans did to Jesus, doubters scatter. Every instinct in your body says what they did to him, they're going to do to me. Non-believers turn and flee. But Thomas doesn't. Thomas remains committed to the community of faith of which he's a part. Thomas remains with the disciples, even without their teacher and their leader, even without the one they've rallied around for 3 years, even without the one who has the power to walk on water, to calm the storms on the sea, to call Lazarus out of the tomb, even without Jesus, Thomas remains with the 12. He doesn't do what Peter does and go back to his life before Jesus catching fish on the seaside. He remains with the disciples, with his faith family, for better or worse, because he is committed to the cause that they are engaged in. Even when Thomas doesn't see the whole picture, Thomas trusts that he has seen God at work in this small community of believers, and for better or for worse, he wants to be faithful where God has placed him. We don't tend to think of this as faith. We call it maybe pragmatism, or at worst, apathy. But I want to suggest to you, isn't your willingness to fight with your kids to make sure that they're wearing clean clothes, even if it's just for a couple hours and aren't yet covered in sticky, based on your trust that the benefit your kids get from being here outweighs the stress it places on you to get them here? Isn't your willingness to continue doing something that you've done for longer than you would care to admit you've done it, based on your trust that the things that you do have value beyond themselves? Faith, pistos, is about admitting that we are part of something bigger than ourselves, even if we don't know where it is going to lead, and even if we don't see the whole picture. It's about trusting that God has a plan beyond us, and our responsibility in it, our faith in it, our trust in it, is simply in showing up, putting in time, even when we don't want to, even when that seems hard. And you can call it faith if you want, or call it head faith if you want. But make no mistake that Thomas displays a remarkable amount of it. The second part of the story shows Thomas displaying a faith that is a willingness to accept where Jesus is calling you to go, even without him having to prove it. Now, Thomas places a high burden of proof on himself to overcome. Notice, however, that Thomas's stubborn commitment to his community doesn't end even when he doesn't believe the same things they do. I think that's a model for church today. But for Thomas, there's the story that the church is telling of a Jesus who has risen from the dead is simply not enough for him to believe. Even if Jesus stood in front of him, he says, he could simply be a ghost or some kind of hallucinogenic magic. So Thomas says, unless I can place my hand in his side, unless I can touch the mark where the nails went through his hands and his feet, I will not believe. In other words, he's saying, I can be sure that the person that I saw die in front of me, unless I can have every sliver of doubt wiped away from my mind and literally hold the person of Jesus in my hand, I will not trust this story. That's all well and good. And to paraphrase that great philosopher, Mike Tyson, everyone has a plan until they start getting punched in the face. Because the very next time that the disciples are all together, Jesus appears with an agenda specifically for Thomas. Go ahead, he says. Take the exact proof that you were looking for. Touch my hands, touch my feet, put your hand in my side, reach out, take your certainty, and take hold of it. But before Thomas can even react, before he can really even think about it, his heart bursts from his chest and he makes a declaration that I'm not even sure he was fully aware he was making. My Lord and my God. Thomas's faith makes a leap from his head to his heart. But notice here what he doesn't do. He doesn't reach his hand out and put his fingers in the holes in Jesus' hands and feet like he said he was going to. He doesn't place his hand in Jesus' side like he said he needed to. Instead, he exclaims two truths that he now understands in new ways. One material truth, one spiritual truth. My Lord and my God. In view of the resurrected Christ, Thomas is willingly surrendering everything that he has and everything that he is. To recognize here that the risen Christ is Lord is to grasp the full consequence of the resurrection. It is itself a political statement, a declaration that what once belonged to the empire now belongs to the risen Christ. This is a shift in values and priorities that inevitably results in a shift in action. And to recognize that this is not just the rightful ruler standing in front of him, but that this is God himself. For a Jew in the first century would be tantamount to blasphemy. To admit it, is to admit to himself that his previous theology was wholly insufficient. Because if people can rise from the dead, not as a ghost, but as a tangible, physical, human body with holes that remain, who is Thomas to put God in a box? Who are we? Who are we to limit what God can do or who through whom he can work? Thomas willingly acknowledges that Jesus Christ is not just Lord, but God, and places everything he knows to be true about the world, every calculus he can imagine, on the altar of his encounter with the risen Christ. And John's words at the end of this story serve as both an invitation to discover Thomas-like faith and also a commendation to carry it forward. This shows us something about what faith is and also something about what faith isn't. Faith is being willing to make that leap, to change in bold and admittedly frightening ways in view of the reality that God has placed in front of you. But faith is not about how big a leap you can take. God never requires grand gestures or opulent sacrifices from us. The times in the Bible where he does, it's always been about challenging those who've been faithful in the past to continue to be more faithful in the future. But the fact that prophets like Amos and Micah and Isaiah call the thinking that says that big leaps earn God's favor more than small ones is utterly detestable to the prophets. After all, if our God is in the business of creating somethings out of nothings, why would he need a showy gesture when a small one would suffice? Luke 18:8 tells us exactly what God is looking for from his people. When the Son of Man comes, will he find faith on the earth? Martin Luther King famously observed the best definition of faith that I've ever read. Faith is taking the first step even when you can't see the rest of the staircase. Thomas's story is a story of twin faithfulness. Faithfulness of varied kinds. Some of us are fortunate enough to be one Thomas or the other. Some of us at times are both. But Thomas's steady dedication to the place God placed him and his willingness to encounter the risen Christ exactly as he was is a picture not of doubt, but of trust, of real, complex, three-dimensional trust. To embody both the commitment of faith and the willingness of faith is where God calls us to be as a church. This is, make no mistake, an age of deep uncertainty for the future of the church in every form. And so we need both kinds of faithfulness. We need good shepherds who can steward the resources of time and talent and treasure that God has given us here and now. If only because every indication of the future says that the trend away from church attendance and away from church participation is only going to continue. But by the same token, we need people who are willing to fall on their knees and exclaim without control, "My Lord and my God," to place everything they have on the altar of the risen Christ. Because our God is a resurrection God who is in the business of bringing somethings out of nothings. The resurrection of Jesus challenges us to trust in God more than what we see, and to recognize that that is also faithfulness, that that is also steady caretaking of God's church. The mistake we so often make is assuming that one kind of faith is better than another or prioritizing one over the other. Like Thomas, may our faith as a church be twinned. Thanks be to God. Amen.